He's exactly halfway through his first four-year term as Attorney General, so it's a great time for a Newsmakers interview with Attorney General Brad Schimmel. General, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Steve.
You have made your top priority fighting heroin and opioid abuse. Is that going to remain your top priority in 2017?
Oh, absolutely. We're far from done on this, and maybe perhaps recently you've seen some of the new public service announcements we've been running. We're constantly trying to have fresh approaches to this so people don't get bored and that they keep paying attention. And I'll tell you, in 2015, when we did this kind of interview a year ago, I was very optimistic about the potential we had. Now we've started to see some of that potential realized. We launched the Dose of Reality campaign in September of 2015. We were out to make every household in Wisconsin aware of the role they can play in going after this problem. We know, for instance, 70% of the time when people start abusing prescription painkillers, they didn't get them from a doctor or a drug dealer, or at least not a traditional drug dealer. They got them from a family member or a friend. So if we can get people to use prescriptions only as they're prescribed to them, and then store them safely, securely in their homes, and then get rid of them when they're done taking them, we can reduce by 70% the people who start abusing those medications. Well, in Wisconsin, we saw in our April drug take-back day, we shattered all previous records. Over 64,000 pounds of unused medications were collected in Wisconsin that day. Put us number three in the nation, behind only Texas and California. California collected 200 pounds more than us. Now, fast forward to October, our most recent drug take-back day, we are number two in the nation. This time, only Texas stayed ahead of us. They beat us by 600 pounds. We collected over 59,000 pounds. All told, since I've been AG and we took over the drug collection days, we've had four of them. We've collected over 207,000 pounds. That's 10 semi-trucks of medications we hauled off to be safely incinerated. And I love those numbers, but more importantly, I love what those numbers mean, because those numbers mean that people in Wisconsin understand that they have a role to play in getting us out of this problem. Get those medications out of your homes.
But I recently saw a stat, I think it was Representative Clayfish's Coalition to Combat Heroin. There's been a 10% drop in some of these prescriptions.
Yep.
Is that a result of the medical society toughening those standards, or is that a major achievement?
That is a tremendous achievement, and to put it in perspective, we don't even have our mandatory PDMP in place yet, our prescription drug monitoring program. Every other state that has made checking the PDMP mandatory has seen a dramatic drop, like 40 and 50% reductions.
And this is an online registry, right?
Yeah.
Where every time a pharmacist dispenses one of these, it's recorded who gets it, how often, and it's a statewide or is it a national network?
We're interconnected with most other states. Not all their states are on the national network, but you know, then prescribers, your doctor, your dentist, your nurse practitioner, they check it and they see, wow, why are you getting OxyContin from this other doctor? And they can start to ask questions. When other states have made that mandatory, they see a huge drop. We haven't had that go into place yet. We got the 10% drop by just having the medical community start to change their practices. And I'm really proud of what the medical community in Wisconsin is doing. And it's the medical society, the medical examining board, the dental examining board, the hospitals association, the pharmacy society, the dental association, all hands on deck. And we're changing. We're changing how we're prescribing, and a 10% drop is a big deal.
When does that new online system kick in, John?
It'll be early next year. They're already testing it now.
They are.
So far it's going well. They just want to make sure before it goes live that there aren't bugs.
At your press conference with the Secretary of Transportation, Secretary Gottlieb said he was surprised that the number of drug-related fatalities had doubled, I think, in 10 years to 149. Is it becoming as dangerous now to be out on the roads because of drug-addicted drivers as it is someone who's been over-drinking?
Well, I'll tell you, in a certain sense, it's more dangerous because most of the time, people that are going to drink alcohol and get out behind the wheel, most of the time, you can avoid the time of day that they're doing that by not being on the road between about 11 p.m. and 3:30 a.m. Mm-hmm. when people are driving under the influence of some prescription medication, they're taking that all day. And so we're seeing a lot more cases where there's a traffic stop for unsafe driving, and they're finding a person under the influence of a medication at 11 o'clock in the morning. And oftentimes it might be a mom with her kids in the car. And she didn't take seriously the warnings on the bottle. Let's say, don't operate heavy equipment or drive an automobile after taking these. She didn't take that seriously, and she's out, in a certain sense, inadvertently, but she is impaired. And it doesn't require intent to be an intoxicated driver. So that message we sent with Department of Transportation is one I'm really excited about.
One of the recommendations of Representative Clefish's Coalition to Combat Heroin is recommending a new state law. High school students would consent to drug testing if they are part of extracurricular activities or park on school property. Could you support that?
You know, I don't know yet two things. I don't know exactly what the bill proposes to do. I just know what's been reported basically through his office's press release. And I haven't seen it, and I don't know what's motivated it. I'm interested to hear that. Where's the groundswell coming from this? I'll tell you this, as I think about drug testing regimens, and we're about to announce a policy at DOJ relating to drug testing, but I want to deliver that policy carefully because I want to also deliver the message that if you're on my team over at Department of Justice and you're struggling with addiction, I want to get you help. If you're doing good work for us, my goal is not to find an excuse to send you out the door. My goal is to get you to be a healthy person who's safe in the workplace. And whenever I hear about drug testing regimens, I hope that's how people are approaching it. We're actually urging, through our Dose of Reality campaign, we're urging employers to consider drug testing. But with just that same message, you invest a lot to get a high-quality employee working to produce for your company. You had to find them, you had to vet them, you had to go through the hiring process, you had to train them, get them up to speed. Don't write them off. If they need help, how about you become a place where they feel it's safe to come ask for help? We know that about 10% of the population struggles with addiction. That's a lot of people to write off.
So we're not winning the war, but we made major strides in a year.
I'd say that's fair, yeah.
Okay, let's go on to a different subject. Representative Jesse Kramer is drafting a bill that would allow carrying of concealed weapons on Wisconsin college campuses. Could you support that?
I like to be careful about going too far out of my lane because I promise that I will enforce the law as it exists and I will defend the law as it exists, and it's up to the legislature to write it. Now, if it's a matter of, there's going to be a debate whether this is something that you simply allow, and then it's up to the school to make their own determination as to what's best for their campus. That battle's going to wage on, and I don't know how that's going to end. I'll say this: when we allow law-abiding citizens to carry, to exercise their Second Amendment right, and to do it in a concealed way, it's not ended up with the gunfight at the OK Corral that some were concerned about. It really hasn't. In almost all, I'm not aware of a specific case where someone's used their gun improperly because they were carrying concealed, but I suppose that case exists. But it's almost always a circumstance where nothing bad happens or the person has used their firearm in a lawful way to defend themselves or someone else.
So the chancellor today, Chancellor Blank, said, do we really want guns, in UW-Madison dorms and the Kohl Center and at Camp Randall football games? So are you saying if we pass this law, give campuses like UW-Madison the ability to opt out of it, sir?
I'm not taking a position on that. They need to determine that based on hearings in the legislature. What I'm saying is, from a public safety perspective, we run the concealed carry program for the state, and we're at about 300,000 individual unique concealed carry permit holders in the state of Wisconsin now. We run the handgun hotline where we do the background checks, and this year we've been shattering records for the number of people purchasing handguns and seeking the background checks. What I'm saying is we need to make sure we keep our focus on who we're really worried about. The law-abiding gun owner who carries their firearm isn't the person we need to most fear. It's the one who doesn't care about the law, the one who's heading out to rob a liquor store or assault someone on the street. They don't really care whether the law says they're committing a misdemeanor by carrying that weapon concealed improperly.
New subject. The Supreme Court rejected your proposal for a special master on John Doe's.
Yeah, I'd say disagreed.
Disagreed. Is there an active DOJ investigation into the John Doe leaks?
Yes.
There is. Does it focus just on the leaks to the Guardian or all leaks?
It's focusing on the leaks to the Guardian. If we discover some other government actors who have leaked it to some other source improperly, we would pursue that as well. But the only one we're aware of is the Guardian leaks.
So it focuses then on government officials, government actors,
right,
and not the other gentleman who got the earlier
right
leaks. It doesn't focus on him.
Right, because the order prohibiting a private citizen from talking about what government has done to them is not legal. It violates the First Amendment, at the very least. Could you imagine how improper it would be if we lived in a society, and Fidel Castro's Cuba would be an example, where if you perceive government committing some wrong against you and you were prohibited from saying anything to anyone about it, that's a frightening prospect. So any orders issued against private citizens in the course of that John Doe, those aren't valid. I can't prosecute someone for violating an invalid order.
Another new subject. DOJ just represented the Elections Commission on the recount. Is there any tightening or any clarification of state laws on recounts that were exposed by this incident?
Yes, all the information from Mr. Haas and the Elections Commission is that they have identified some places that the law can be improved, and that's good news. I think they may have discovered that because they were going through an audit anyway. It just wasn't going to have the same time frame as the recount. I suspect the audit probably would have discovered the same issues.
Do you think someone who finishes fourth with 1% of the vote should have a right for a recount if she or he pays for it?
I think this is an important open government issue. I think anyone who will pay the costs that it takes for government to do this and wants to be assured that the results of the election are honest, I don't know how we deny that. I think it's a fundamental part of our democracy that someone who says, I'm not so sure, has the right to ask. And if they pay for it, so be it. I know it was a lot of trouble for the state. I know that some are arguing it's for other motivations. You know, when we get a public records request, we don't make an assessment, what's your motivation for mm-hmm. it? We mm-hmm. simply make an assessment, is this a government record that we're required to hold, and does the law provide we should turn it over?
The debate over interference or hacking, are you satisfied that Wisconsin has a system of running elections that we cannot be hacked, or does that statement go too far?
It's not online. The machines aren't hooked up to the internet, so hacking's not a possibility. We had concerns in previous elections about whether some individuals are coming in and purporting to be someone they're not. The voter ID law has addressed that, and I've been very pleased with our client, the state that we represent, because we approached them with some of the things that we thought would be legal concerns in the ongoing court cases. And for instance, the concern that there were going to be some who are eligible voters who can't produce the documents they need and would be prevented from voting because of that. And our clients took steps to frankly err on the safe side. I think there may be some people who ultimately aren't eligible to vote who may end up with an ID to be able to go, the temporary ID necessary to go do it, because we can't confirm that they're not eligible. And that's better than denying somebody who is eligible their right to vote.
Do you think the number of people that couldn't vote because they didn't have the photo ID is relatively small? And if so, are we talking about dozens or 100 or so?
At this point, I'm not aware of any case where an individual has pursued the temporary ID process through DOT and not been granted. As long as we can't demonstrate that they're ineligible, they've all been granted that temporary ID so they could vote.
That whole issue of how someone can be able to vote and the documents they have to present is still pending in federal court. My question is, do we need to clarify that in the next session? Do we need to clean up those laws on the process, General?
You know, there was an emergency rule put in place relative to some of the procedures that the Department of Motor Vehicles was utilizing. We should make that, we'll move forward and make that permanent, but I think beyond that, I think that the November 8th election demonstrated that things went pretty well. So, and I hope the results of that we didn't have chaos. We don't have an outcry of people who've been denied their right to vote. I hope that plays a role in the federal court's decision.
As a professional law officer, what's your reaction to the national debate over the potential hacking by a foreign body, I won't say Russians, all that's being debated, of the DNC, of the RNC? Are you concerned about what that could lead to?
I am concerned every day about the dangers of people being compromised on the internet. Certainly getting at voting materials is something that should give us great pause. And in those states where they are hooked up to the internet somehow relative to voting, they should probably be thinking carefully about the dangers that might pose. Wisconsin, it's not a concern, but actually internet crime is a growing concern. More and more, the best criminals don't ever leave their home. They don't have to break into your house to get your money. They don't have to forge a check. They just electronically get your information and start abusing it. And that's a growing problem. And we've got a gap, frankly, in law enforcement because it's difficult for local law enforcement to take that issue on because odds are the person who committed that cybercrime doesn't live in their jurisdiction. So how are they going to go pursue somebody in Florida or Belarus or you name it? How is the local police department going to do that? The feds have more ability to do it, but there's tremendous resources, so they've set their threshold for taking on a case so high that there's a huge gap in between there of situations where people can lose a very substantial part of their savings, for instance. And we've got kind of a gap, and it's something that we've been talking about as state DOJ is that we may be the place where we need to fill that gap, but it will take resources.
What's your reaction to yesterday's disclosure that 1 billion accounts at Yahoo were hacked in 2013, 3 years ago? So the next time a Wisconsin resident asked you, generally in light of the 1 billion hack, which followed 500 million accounts being hacked, what can we do? What are you going to tell them?
Well, there are two concerns. First off, this doesn't surprise me anymore. I mean, this is just becoming so routine.
So should everybody assume that their personal account and passwords have been hacked? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I think people should assume that it is a possibility at all times and be careful about what you transmit. Only, you know, if you're going to give credit card information or other personal private information that could harm you over the internet if it's in the wrong hands, you better be sure about who you're giving it to. Be careful about it. But there are a couple concerns. One is we need to be better prepared as a nation to investigate these things and to hold people accountable for it. Because right now, the people that engage in this kind of activity, they feel pretty confident they're going to get away with it because nobody's going to come and get them. You know, the citizen whose credit card was compromised, they're not going to end up eating the bill for that. The credit card company will. We all will eat it eventually when those costs are spread out to us. But that individual citizen, they're probably not going to be standing on the steps of the Wisconsin Capitol demanding to do something because the credit card company or the bank covered them. The other piece of this is there's a wide spectrum on how much industries can spend to protect their customers' information. Mm-hmm. And some of them screw up and they spend almost nothing. And they should be held accountable when they do that, when they didn't put enough of a safeguard in place to protect. But you can spend so much money that you just put yourself out of business. It's a difficult balance to decide where on that spectrum.
Should we stop paying our bills online, General?
I think you just need to be sure about who you're submitting your information to.
Okay, new subject. The federal investigation of Lincoln Hills is still going on, so I'm going to ask a broader question. If 70% of juveniles sent there are minorities, should the state juvenile prison be closer to Milwaukee? Should it be in Milwaukee County?
You know, that's a decision for the Department of Corrections and perhaps the legislature, because you're talking about some significant expenditures to do it. So I'm not an expert on juvenile corrections from that aspect. I did serve, though, years ago on a legislative task force that examined juvenile corrections and serious juvenile offenders. And one of the things we explored was a program called the Missouri Model. And the Missouri Model did involve smaller institutions in the urban areas where closer to the neighborhoods where the individual committed to those institutions lived. And there's a lot to be said for that. They have more contact with their families as a result. And the studies do demonstrate that the more contact the juvenile has with their families, the more likely they're going to come out and be law-abiding when they get out. And then the other thing that's important is the service agencies that are going to serve them when they return to the communities to make sure they stay on track and get the treatment resources they need, etc. They're able to get to them earlier. They're able to start working with them before they get released. So I think there's a lot of promise in that, and I do hope that as a state we're going to explore some of those other options.
Another new subject. Federal judges have ruled the 2011 redistricting plan illegal. If that order is upheld, perhaps on a 4-4 deadlock of the U.S. Supreme Court, what's a reasonable fix? Redrawing lines for the 2018 elections?
Well, I'm concerned about the idea that that judges would sit down and do it. That's happened before in cases where racial redistricting inequities have been found to be improper. We're in new territory here because we've not had the high court ever find that a political
there's a new redistricting standard, map. The efficiency gap.
Yeah, this is being proposed. Yeah.
Right. Do you object to that new standard? Is that not realistic?
We think it has some serious flaws to it. For instance, that there is kind of a natural tendency for people of the same kind of political persuasion to live in the same areas. In particular, urban areas tend to be highly concentrated with people who vote Democratic. It's hard to create a map where that vote isn't somewhat diluted because they're all gathered in the same district.
That's the community of interest idea, isn't it? Yeah, excuse me.
So, I mean, you could have political districts that look like a hub of a wheel where you've got, or a pie.
A pie.
Which would be very odd, and it might not be any, it might not make anyone very happy. So I don't know. We think that there are serious flaws with the efficiency model that's being proposed. We're in new territory, and so we're looking forward to the argument. This is going to take a while. By the time briefing is done, we don't even have a final decision from the 3-judge panel because we have yet to submit our briefs and reply briefs on the remedy.
Right, potential fixes.
Yeah.
So you haven't even come up with any,
right.
DOJ has not had to submit potential remedies, to use a legal term.
We are prepared to file our brief, but we're preparing to file our brief, but we haven't even told the court what we'd suggest for a remedy yet.
Okay, just a couple more questions. Today, the Milwaukee County DA charged a former Milwaukee policeman. Has the law that passed, your agency has to investigate officer-involved shootings, has that worked? And have there been so many shootings that it's hurt your agency's resources and the ability to do other investigations?
I think we're handling them effectively. Initially, we were struggling, and I wasn't happy with back in 2015. We were seeing the investigations take a pretty long time, many months, and that troubled me. We have in 2016 put in new standards that we expect these to be done in the investigation part to be done in 30 days, so we can turn something over to the prosecutor to start examining, and we've been hitting that mark. I think this law makes a lot of sense to, and it's not necessarily an actual conflict, but it's the public perception of a conflict that we're working to avoid. In this kind of investigation, there's no place where public confidence in the outcome is more important. So to have this removed from the agency where the officer involved in the use of deadly force works and have someone outside do it is going to increase that public confidence. And really, there are a relative handful of agencies in the state that have the resources to step in, to do these investigations for someone else, and have the repetitions to be experts at it. And Department of Justice is one of those.
After these incidents, the family members and their attorneys demand to see the video. Now, right. The video in this case has not yet been released. Why can there be such a delay in the release of the video?
Well, during the course of the investigation, we'll hold off on releasing it for a number of reasons. And they all really relate to that public confidence. If we release the video early, and we haven't completed our investigation, well, when we go back to talk with people about with follow-up questions or identify new people to interview, and they've seen the video on television, well, now they just pattern their answers to fit what they saw. And nobody can be confident in the truth of their recollections. It's misleading to watch a video and decide, often is misleading, to watch the video and decide that that this is the answer. This is what happened. Here is the resolution of the case. There's much more to it. The squad camera or body camera video is just one piece of a large puzzle of information. And so when we release the information, we don't want to release it piecemeal. We want to release it in a way that the public can look and the media can look at this comprehensively and make an assessment based on a small piece, but on the whole picture. And of course, if the DA is going to go forward with prosecution, this becomes their decision to release evidence, because they've got to make sure that down the line they can pick a jury that's going to give a fair trial to both sides.
So it wasn't your call to release the video in this case?
My decision during the investigation was that we would not release it. Once we turn the case over to the district attorney, that becomes their decision.
I see. Okay, final issue. Your office has joined other attorneys generals in suing the Obama administration several times over the Clean Power Plan, overtime rules, use of school bathrooms by transgender students. Do all these controversies go away if President Trump rescinds these executive orders?
Well, yes and no. Some of the litigation will go away. It's not going to be done on January 21st. Even if the president starts crossing out, so to speak, prior executive orders, they're still going to have to go back to have the regulatory agencies rescind them formally. Mm-hmm. And that requires compliance with the Administrative Procedures Act. And so it's going to take a little time. In the meantime, we still need to prepare for the litigation if it keeps moving forward in the courts. I do expect that the relationship's going to change, but it's important to keep in mind, President Obama didn't invent executive orders. He didn't invent the use of regulatory rules to change the relationship between the federal government and the states. He didn't invent that. Before him, the record holder was a Republican president, George W. Bush, had become the new title holder. President Obama has used it more, but it's not unheard of for Republican presidents to do it. There will always be a certain conflict between the states and the federal government over who has what authority. And it's going to be the state attorneys general who are going to be fighting to defend the power and the authority of the states. And there's another piece to this, and that is that we did a lot of research in being able to go to court and get injunctions against many of these regulatory rules. We figured out what is legal, what is not legal, and we're prepared to help the administration hit down the fairway, so to speak. We've also take with the Clean Power Plan, we've explored an awful lot about what things can make sense. The idea of having cleaner emissions from power plants, from manufacturing plants, that's a laudable idea. We just need to approach it in a way that we don't destroy the state's economy in the process. We have a lot of ideas that we're prepared to help with. So we have an ongoing role as state attorneys general in this.
Last question, I promise. Do you expect the priorities of the Trump administration to more align with your goals for the next 2 and 4 years, assuming you run again?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I don't agree with him on everything that he's announced, but there's some things I like. The thing that, as state attorney general in my official role, that I like hearing is that we're going to make the federal government smaller and we're going to return more power to the states. I like that.
And then what gives you pause? The proof will be in how he does it.
There will be. And I think, you know, sometimes he has expectations that things are going to move easier than he thinks they will. But we'll see. He's the only politician I've ever seen who can say the things he says and pull it off. And I agree that we could focus less on being politically correct, be sensitive, but sometimes we go too far. I'm with him on that. I'm going to continue to be cautious about what I say. We won't have the same style, but you know what? I am excited. I think that a lot of Americans, including me, really want to see things change in government. And I think almost everybody else that was in part of this nomination process on both sides, almost everybody else was going to do these in incremental ways. And I think he might be the one that does it in really big, sweeping ways. And I'm kind of excited for what it looks like.
Attorney General Brad Schimmel, thanks for your time. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you.